to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Hi, welcome to The Leap, coming to you live from the Lion Hotel in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Sarah Gordon. I own a small business, Gordy's Pickle Jar, and one of my favorite things about being a small business owner is talking with and learning from other entrepreneurs. And every Wednesday, I get to have these conversations on air by bringing together small business owners from a wide range of disciplines to share stories, wisdoms, tips, and advice. On today's show, I'm super excited to chat with D.C.'s beloved taqueria and owner, Mike Leonard. Hey, Mike.
Good afternoon.
Thanks so much for joining me here today. Taquerian is a Korean-Mexican fusion fast casual that grew from a single food truck to five locations and now is in two cities. Yeah.
Yep. Just made the leap to Philadelphia.
Nice. Before we chat about all things Taquerian, I wanted to chat a bit about the road that led you here. What's your background? Have you always worked in the food industry?
No, I really didn't work in the food industry at all before Taquerian. I had one job as a host at a ski lodge that was serving sort of high-end food. That was for maybe 4 months of my life. I did an internship at Chef Jeff's when I was 16 for 2 weeks, and that was about it. Before I started Taquerian, I was in specialty outdoor retail and some outdoor education type stuff, but mostly the retail and management operations. So I would run as a manager kayak stores. I used to run stores for Hudson Trail Outfitters, which was a chain in the DC area, and selling the dream.
Yeah. And so how did you decide to kind of give up that and start a business, and specifically, like, how did you decide to go to the kind of the food truck route?
Well, food had always been appealing to me. I had a hobby cooking at home, loved food, but I also felt like I understood the business operational aspects, so I felt like I actually could be successful, not just like a hobby that turns into something. I thought I could be very serious at it. And I was backpacking in New Zealand, I guess 2 or 3 years before Taquerian opened, and I remember thinking about street vending. I didn't even know if I was going to move back to D.C. specifically. I am from D.C. But I was thinking about, like, you know, I make about $35,000, $40,000 a year being a manager here. You know, I bet I could pay myself about $40,000 a year if I did this. I was, like, running the numbers. I was thinking, oh, I could sell, like, you know, sausages. I could have a street cart outside of an office building. Like, I could just, you know, I could pay myself about this amount, you know?
Yeah. Because you were pretty young when you started Taquerian, right?
I was 24.
Yeah.
But really, as that evolved, I was working at the time at Potomac Paddle Sports, which is still a great kayaking instructional school for adults in the D.C. area. They have a store in Potomac now, but they used to have a store in Rockville, and I was kind of the director of operations. Pretty small operation, but, you know, I started getting more and more serious about this idea of vending, and I was looking into the regulations in D.C. and found out that actually there's a moratorium on sidewalk vending in D.C., and the only opportunity was this new loophole that a new food truck had just found, you know, for this mobile vending. And this was before mobile vending was big. It was just the Fajol brothers.
Wow. What year was that?
2009. We opened in 2010, but so it was an interesting time for vending, and so the project got bigger than I thought. You know, food truck cost $60,000-$80,000 bucks, so I ended up deciding, okay, I need to open a food truck.
So did you guys, so you basically got into the scene through this loophole?
Yeah, so, you know, there was always vendors like on the mall. It's kind of a different system, and there were always ice cream trucks. So at the time, there was no real way for there to be mobile vending the way there is now in D.C. You know, one of the owners of the Fajol brothers worked with somebody in D.C. government to discover that you could actually abide by the ice cream truck rule, but with hot food. If you did this thing where you can never stop unless you're flagged down by a customer, and you can only continue to be at a place as long as you have a queue of customers. So back in those days, Twitter was incredibly successful for us, and we could literally mobilize, you know, 35 people at Franklin Square, tell them we're going to show up at 11:20, and you'd have people there to flag you down, and you'd have a line through lunch, and the line would end, and you'd be like, okay, well, we'll leave now.
Fascinating.
People don't respond on social media like that to food trucks anymore because it's saturated and, yeah, and interests are pulled. But at the time,
I mean, and the regulations have changed, right? They've like come a
long
way.
Yeah, they have. Yeah, yeah. The ice cream truck rule is gone. Now people are allowed to stand and wait for customers. So.
Yeah. So how did you guys decide to kind of, you know, move from food truck to like brick and mortar?
You know, it was kind of in my head after the first year. You know, when I first opened, I thought, we're going to open lots of food trucks. This is going to be a food truck company. We're going to have different concepts of food trucks. Then I realized vending is really hard. Sorry, this is kind of in the way. I can't see that well. vending is proportionally harder than it has to be for the amount of money you make. Now, it's a really, really cool way to start, and I actually really enjoyed it. But it's difficult. There's a lot of variables, parking, mechanical breakages, things like that. So I was like, you know, a store environment's actually much more controllable in that way. So we kind of looked for real estate, but really we got a great opportunity with Union Market. Richie Brandenburg found us, emailed us, met with me, said, hey, we're doing this new thing. It's in the middle of nowhere in this wholesale district, but we're going to build it to be great. You know, you want to take a leap. And I was actually very nervous about signing that deal. I was like, oh, this is in the middle of nowhere. How are they going to make this work? You know, I'm on the hook for money now, you know, all this stuff. And it ended up being actually very low risk and very high reward.
Yeah. So, I mean, you guys are packed there like every day, right?
Yeah. Union Market's been very successful for us in multiple ways, financially, but also in terms of our being recognized in the city. Mm-hmm. So many people go there, and so many people know us from there, even at other locations. Or when I meet people, they're like, oh, yeah, you're at Union Market. And then the other thing, being with a larger landlord group gives you reputability for other large landlord groups. So, you know, if they're deciding between Chipotle or, oh, Takarian wants to sign in this corner spot in Clarendon, the fact that you've successfully paid rent to a big company means something to them. It's almost like a resume, so...
Right. So Eden's got your back.
Yeah, I'd like to think so.
Nice. So did you have any like kind of mentors along the way when you first started, and kind of what advice did they give you?
I had mentors from my previous jobs that weren't specifically relatable to food, but management, ownership, philosophy. I've learned a lot along the way from people who I've thought have done things wrong. I think that's really, you know, learning through that kind of observation is very, very important. We had a real community with the food trucks. I never really felt like I had a mentor that knew so much more than me, but we all mentored each other, and like we worked through our problems together. So, you know, there was a handful of trucks I was very close with, and we formed an association. You know, it was a very tight-knit community, especially for a couple of years.
So how did you decide once did you like ditch the truck when you like opened the first kind of brick and mortar in Union Market?
No, we actually did the truck for 5 years total. So
You still had it when you started Union Market.
Yeah, and for 2.5 years after that. We closed it after we opened at the Yards, which was in the winter of 2014.
Okay. Because it was time.
Yeah, you know, I think that we were going into that winter. We knew it was slow during the winter. We had a need for some of those staff members at other locations, and we thought, oh, maybe we'll open it again in the spring. And then it got to be spring, and I was like, we're not getting this thing going again.
Yeah. So today you guys have, what, 5 locations, right?
5 locations, yeah.
What have been some of the challenges kind of in that expansion?
You know, certainly, you know, financially you get more spread thin. I mean, the Union Markets or the, what we have at National Place, the food courts are a pretty low investment. But, you know, at the Yards or U Street, they are, you know, large investments and they require large bank loans. So, you know, you have to be in a good position to get those bank loans. And then, you know, they're complicated projects. But you know, I've learned a lot along the way. I think having good partners, like for construction, it's very important. I don't know. There's been a lot of challenges along the way. Yeah. I'm trying to identify the.
I mean, I guess for like, you know, fast casual space or restaurants like at large. I mean, kind of the real estate, you know, play and the location is so huge, right?
Site selection is incredibly important.
Yeah.
And you see, you know, other large businesses that are not able to sustain themselves, not to be named, but the point is that site selection is incredibly important. It's even more important now than it was before. You know, there are certain types of restaurants that are such great quality and so unique that they can draw a crowd from anywhere. And that's a beautiful thing. Part of, you know, being in fast casual, Taquerian, you know, knowing who we are, I love our food, I believe in our food, but we're not that, right? We kind of were that a little bit, you know, in 2010, because DC's changed a little bit.
DC's, a lot.
Yeah, like a lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're not that. We need to be convenient for people. People are not going to chase us, you know, across town, because it's the best taco in the world. And so site selection becomes incredibly important. And that's the same, you know, for a Cava, Sweetgreen, you know, whoever else, you know, even the newer, trendier, like a Rasa or something like that, they do a great job, but you know, it's not quite worth driving across town just to get them, you know.
You need the foot traffic,
right?
Yeah. Have you seen you know, kind of a change in, since, I mean, DC's just kind of feels like it's ever evolving, you know? It just kind of 5 years ago, I feel like it just burst into, you know, the spotlight to, I don't know, everyone seemed to want to have a restaurant here.
I kind of feel like it's still like that.
Yeah.
And it's not slowing down appropriately.
Yeah. So how has that kind of affected kind of business on your guys' side?
Yeah. I mean, in fast casual, it's gotten very crowded. National concepts coming in, local concepts getting bigger. I think that actually we've sustained very well. Even looking at Union Market's still very popular and very successful, but it's slightly less popular than it was last year, for example. You've got projects like The Wharf, you've got mm-hmm. other food halls opening up, you know, Annandale, The Spot, different places that are pulling people's interests in different directions. It's very difficult to stay new and fresh and the best. It is challenging. You need to be, you know, we'll have a 30% increase 1 year and then a 12% decrease the next year. And you're thinking, wow, 12% decrease is so terrible. But then I remind myself, well, we're up 22% to 2 years ago. That's pretty good. So, you know, there's a lot of that happening. And I think that's happening even with fine dining restaurants as well, where they were wildly popular a year ago. This year, they're still fine. You know, it's still a viable business. But they're like, wow, like it just really is that quick, you know.
Right, yeah.
I think you're seeing more things with smaller square footage. That's both fine dining restaurants and fast casual trying to make their concept fit in smaller spaces where there's lower risk. Or for a fine dining restaurant, you know, you could be fully reserved much more easily, you know, than 300 seats, you know, 60 seats, for example.
Where do you kind of see, like, things going kind of like in the next 5 years in D.C.? Right, because I mean, it sometimes doesn't seem sustainable.
I think it's going to be really hard. I hate to be doom and gloom pessimistic. I think some folks are going to be fine. I actually think we're going to be fine. I think, you know, also with fast casual, delivery is really taking a lot, and this is the same. Even in New York, they've got a huge problem with this. You have to pay delivery companies a substantial portion of the sale, and you're not gaining new customers. You're replacing your own customers. So if it's just butter on top, it's like, okay, well, I can make a little less, and that's still going to flow to the bottom line. If you're taking, you know, pieces out of the pie you already had, and those people are converting themselves to delivery customers, ordering Uber Eats, Caviar, you know, Grubhub, whatever, then all of a sudden a piece of your pie is shrinking because you're paying up to 30% on every transaction of those.
So do you guys work with Uber Eats? And
we have an exclusive with Caviar.
Okay.
Which we feel is kind of the higher end option, where the kind of better restaurants have exclusives there. And we think their drivers are a little bit better.
And you find that relationship kind of fruitful?
I mean, we definitely could get a lot more delivery sales. I think it's a ratio. You know, we don't want to turn into a company that we're not. I was actually very hesitant to get into delivery at all. I was very hesitant to get into catering. Now we do catering because I wanted to be laser focused on what we do best, which is serving people in the store. You know, about a year and a half ago, I started to soften on my stubbornness because I was like, you know what, like, it wasn't just the financial thing. I mean, we were still making it. It was more like I got a sense of a belief that customers really are transitioning and it wasn't going to be sustainable unless we diversified. So having an exclusive with Caviar, first of all, lowers the rate because in exchange for that exclusive, you get a slightly better rate. And the other thing is that, yeah, we actually don't want too many delivery sales. We don't want 50% of our sales to be delivery.
Right,
we want
and nobody coming into the store.
15% of our sales to be delivery. And we don't want to muck up our operations with drivers coming in and out all the time where our customers are still trying to do what they always did. So.
Right. So it's such a fine line because, you know, I feel like consumers these days just want, you know, want things to be convenient and quick and, you know, they want you to kind of, I feel like, have that diversity in
your
portfolio.
It's interesting. The delivery companies aren't profitable either. No one's making profit on the model. And I haven't seen, you know, Uber Eats is always complaining. You know, they charge the full 30% and they don't even negotiate that. And they're not going to be profitable with Uber Eats for like 10 years. So it's just an odd thing that so many consumers are using, but nobody's making, restaurants aren't making money on it. Uber's not making money on it. It's just very, very interesting to me to see how it's going to play out. It's like this new world of like massive amounts of injection capital. You know, even some of my fast casual competitors, not to be named, take on just gobs of money and they're in situations where they're forced to sign leases very quickly. I'm assuming site selection suffers. Hopefully not. Maybe they're smart enough to get around that. And, you know, after 3 years, you end up and you've got 100 locations and 40 of them are bad. And, you know, it's just everything is so like the need to make money is going away on the higher end of business. Eventually to catch up, I'm assuming.
Right. I mean, it's got to.
Yeah.
So you guys just expanded to Philly. That's kind of awesome.
Yeah.
So why Philly?
Philly found us. It's the story I like to tell. You know, we're growing, but we really have discovered that, not exclusively, but we like the kind of food hall model for our business. We think we do well in food halls. We also do well at our other stores. You know, like the Yards has been open 5 years. It does really well. But, you know, Union Market and National Place have done really well for us. And we wanted to explore the idea of doing more food halls. And there was a really great food hall opening in Philly. So, you know, if there had been an equivalently good food hall opening in D.C., we might have done that instead. But Philly was just close enough that I felt like we could manage it. We were lucky enough to find one of our general managers wanted to move there.
And, that's great.
Yeah. So it's working out really nicely.
And so do you guys have like, you know, I mean, are you thinking that you're going to expand to more cities or like you're just going to take Philly? But, you know,
right now my thoughts are, well, first of all, we could build out Philly. And also in terms of trendiness, Philly is like 10 years behind. So, you know, we can make a splash there more so than we're able to in DC right now. But Philly's the furthest, right? So more stuff in Philly is possible, but you know, Richmond, even as far as Charlottesville is a little further, but I'm not saying we're specifically looking in those places, but for me, it's about, I can drive there in less than half a day. Right now, New York's too far for me.
Well, you could drive to New York in less than half a day.
Yeah, technically, but it's a big half day.
Yeah. It's a giant leap.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I feel like fast casual is kind of go from like 0 to 100, you know, they have one store and then they have like 500 stores.
Yeah.
So kind of what's your guys' growth strategy been in terms of all that?
Well, it's changed a lot over the years. I'm not quite as aggressive as other people are about raising money. about taking the leap with other people's money. Sometimes I think that's a flaw. Sometimes I think that's a strength. I go back and forth. But you know, our thing is to grow organically, but also with some bank money. So not tons of bank money, but you know, about half to two thirds of the money it costs to open a location would come from the bank. And as long as the bank's still able to lend, as long as we have enough organic capital to match that other half to a third, we would grow like that. And then we'd wait till we get to, you know, 8 to 10 before we'd explore like the bigger options. Because at 8 to 10, you become more attractive to better quality investors. Quality investors, we don't have investors, but whenever I think
you
guys,
you don't have any investors.
I mean, my parents gave me a little bit of money to open the food truck, like $20,000. So yes,
so you're forever in debt to them.
Well, they've got the equity, you know.
Oh, that's good.
It's not liquid, but it's worth a lot on paper, I guess. So no, not really. But I've talked to investors a lot over the years, and I've thought about that investing relationship over the years, and the quality of the investor will always be very, very, very important to me. Both from a, like, they understand what we're doing and they're not going to push us to places that are going to be damaging overall, and that they can, you know, help in productive ways, not unproductive ways. So
right. So you're open to the idea. You just maybe haven't found the right, like, group or person.
Right. Yet. Yeah. And also I just think that, you know, I could do a friends and family raise anytime and raise $1 million or something that would give us maybe two stores or something like that. But friends and family raises have always been very unattractive to me. It's just kind of my personality. I love my friends and family, and I kind of like to just keep that totally separate.
Yeah, right.
It works well for some people. It's not like a bad thing always. It's just not really my style. It just makes me feel different, you know?
There's pressure. You obviously like don't want to, you know,
you don't want to let down people that you really know.
Yeah.
No, I think that, you know, for the larger firms, especially the good quality ones, they don't really consider much until you're at 8 to 10. So it's not easy to raise from them at a very small level. So,
right.
This is what I've found.
Interesting. So what advice or tips would you give someone trying to, you know, go from food truck to brick and mortar? Because I'm assuming that, you know, there's a lot of people in the food truck community that are wanting to do that, right?
Yeah, and there still are. You got to run it like a business. You can't run it like a sole proprietorship. And this is something, even when I used to work every shift on the truck, I thought of myself as an employee on the schedule, and then I thought of myself as the manager of the business in like a separate capacity. It's about the mentality of how you run and separating. Build it so that you don't have to be there, even if you are there. You know, I could still step in and work shifts and keep up with the team, but there's no specific skill that I have that has to be there every day. And I think that when you start to scale and grow, you need to really think carefully about that. And it's never, ever, ever too early to start. You know, I even talk to, you know, people that I work with closely, people who have their own category of responsibilities. And I actually make sure that they document their responsibilities and write kind of standard operating procedures for their responsibilities, because I'm like, okay, well, what if you're on vacation? What if you have a death in the family? You have to be out for a month. You know, how am I going to come in and then do this thing that you've been doing for the last year? Thinking like that is super important, and even about your own responsibilities.
And I mean, wouldn't you say, I mean, I guess, you know, just from hearing you talk, it sounds like a good tip would be, you know, to go from like food truck to food hall potentially prior to like going to brick and mortar because of the risk factor.
Yeah, I mean, the risk factor is huge. I mean, food hall, even a food court, you know, even if it's not that trendy, if it's good real estate and you think there's a lot of people there, even if the rent is high, the cost to open is so much lower. It's less equipment. It's less tiles. It's less construction. It's less of all that stuff. Plus, generally speaking, not every time, but generally speaking, if it really doesn't work, those deals are easier to get out of.
Right. Because someone would love to take your spot.
Exactly.
I mean, you've seen that at Union Market, just kind of
Right. Yeah. I mean, if someone doesn't work out at Union Market for whatever reason, they don't have to pay a big penalty to break their lease, you know, because, you know, the company's like, okay, like, that's cool. Like, we'll just lease it to someone else. Like, we're not going to take you out of business and make you pay some big payout, right? It's not in their interest, right? Whereas if you have like a big standalone space, you know, those can go vacant for a long time. So, you know, the landlord's going to be more strict with their powers there. And that's not just in like a Union Market. It's also in even like a Montgomery Mall, you know, we're not there, but we've looked at it. The rents are extremely high, like it's extremely, extremely high. But, you know, you would still retrofit your space for less. And if it really wasn't working out, like there's five people that want to get in there. So you can assign the contract to somebody else or something like that.
Right.
So you just have more options.
Yeah. Do they do a lot of the build out for you in these food halls?
Generally not.
Okay.
So, I mean, when Union Market first opened, they were in a different position and it was an untested, you know, but.
And it was also like, you certainly know, in the middle like, of nowhere at
yeah,
the time.
New vendors at Union Market get no favors like that. Yeah.
Right.
Generally, no, they don't give you tenant improvement allowance.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, you were going in when.
Right.
You know,
real
people
pioneers.
Were like scared to kind of yeah. go that way.
And we really, you know,
the traffic
weekends
wasn't there.
Were always decent, but like we used to do like $250 on a Thursday. I mean, it was rough for a couple of years, the Union Market too.
Oh, really? Like in the beginning? I always
certainly
like
during
envision
the week.
It. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. During the week. Yeah. But you guys had a lot of university students coming your way there, right?
A lot is relative.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I'll say about this whole conversation regarding DC and all the different, I think regular people don't realize how slammed you have to be to even like kind of break even. It's not enough to go into a place and you're like, oh, you know, there's some people sitting here. This
yeah.
place looks lively. Like if you're not slammed, you're usually kind of failing. And it's weird to say, but if you don't have a line out the door at lunch, like, you need that because you're not going to be busy during the afternoon. You're going to be less busy at night, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, it's just people don't realize how many people it actually takes to
make the numbers work.
Yeah, especially yeah. a fast casual where you have a low average ticket, right? It's not like a restaurant where it's $100 a person. You know, your average ticket's like $11.50, $12. It takes a lot of people to drive the volume.
Right.
I mean, coffee is the hardest of that category. Coffee people are... that do it well are incredible. I mean, I have a lot of respect for the way that they're able to attract that many people because it takes a lot of cups of coffee
to make it work.
Yeah.
It looks like, so we're, you know, Line Hotel is having an event with YouTube. That's the noise that you're hearing behind us. So we're going to wrap this up. Thanks so much for joining Mike and for making DC more delicious. The Leap will be back next Wednesday at noon. See y'all then.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.